Welcome back, everyone. I know we've all been looking forward to hearing from Gunnar Esiason. Gunnar is a cystic fibrosis and rare disease patient leader who's passionate about early stage drug development, patient empowerment, and health policy. He holds an MBA from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and is now working towards a Master's of Public Health at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. He has consulted on clinical trial development, health studies, as well as CF-specific mental health and wellness screening tool. His health policy opinions have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, The Hill, Stat News, and other news sources. Today, he will present My Life with Cystic Fibrosis, Our Unlocked Futures, and Breaking Down Barriers for the Continued Success of the CF Community. Gunnar, welcome.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks to everyone at CFRI and, of course, Siri for having me. So I'm going to jump on here and share my screen so we can get going. My talk today is titled My Life with Cystic Fibrosis, Our Unlocked Futures, and Breaking Down Barriers for the for the Continued Success of the CF Community. I will admit that I think when I chose that title, it was a little long, but here we are, and I appreciate everyone calling in to sit with me for a few minutes this afternoon. So what we're going to talk about first is, you know, who I am, and I'll go through some of my more influential encounters with the medical system. And I had this whole talk planned out, but then of course, my wife Darcy and I were now pregnant and expecting a baby boy the end of this year. So I will save the last 5-10 minutes to talk about the IVF process and everything that we went through to get to this point where we are today. But first, I want to start about, you know, who I am, what do I do, where do I come from? Of course, the Boomer Esiason Foundation is a huge part of my life. It was founded in 1993 when I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. My mom and dad founded the organization, and to date, we are approaching a total of $200 million raised in the fight against cystic fibrosis. And of course, a lot of our funding and resources and efforts goes towards therapeutics and research options for different clinicians and investigators to better understand cystic fibrosis. But most importantly, and I think the thing that I'm most proud about is our financial assistance that we are affording to the CF community. And we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm also a board member at No Patient Left Behind, where we talk about access to breakthrough medications for people with rare diseases, rare cancers, and of course, among the broader healthcare industry. And then as Jim mentioned, I am presently a graduate student. I just finished my MBA this past spring at Tuck, and will be finishing my MPH at Dartmouth this coming year. But I wanna leave this slide here for a second so that anyone on the call who you know, may find themselves in a position to use one of our financial assistance programs to go ahead and do so. Again, that's www.esiason.org, and then navigate to financial assistance. We offer scholarships for people who are going through undergrad, and then of course, graduate students as well. We have a new program, COVID-19 Economic Relief, for folks who have fallen on hard times because of the pandemic over the last year and a half. We also offer transplant assistance grants for folks who are going through the transplant process in cystic fibrosis, whether that's lung or other solid organ transplants. And those cover costs that are not generally touched by insurance coverage. So I'm talking, you know, travel expenses and anything associated with the transplant process that a typical cystic fibrosis patient would go through. And then of course, something that we are proud of as well, and something that is relatively new for the foundation, is our disaster relief fund for folks who are victims of natural disasters across the United States. So I wanna start by talking about my early days with cystic fibrosis, and really when I crossed the threshold into understanding that I had the disease. Of course, my dad was playing in the NFL when I was diagnosed, and after a call with Frank DeFord, who was a very famous sports writer in the 80s, 90s, and then 2000s, his daughter Alex unfortunately passed away from cystic fibrosis many decades ago. But right after I was diagnosed, he called my dad and said, you know, we have an opportunity now to put a face on cystic fibrosis. And it wasn't my choice to be thrown to the spot, but there I was in 1993 on top of my dad's shoulders on the cover of Sports Illustrated. But that, of course, wasn't really when I you know, understood that I had cystic fibrosis, nor did I really know what CF was. And I think most people living with the condition probably recognize there's one influential moment where we realize that, you know what, we might actually be a little different than everyone else. And for me, that was when I was in first grade. I was still receiving care at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And early one morning, my parents came to my room and they woke me up. They said, Gunnar, we're going to Cincinnati Children's. We got to go see the doctor. And of course, this was a little different than most other visits. I could tell right away. I had never been woken up so early to go to the clinic. But there we were on the way to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, the 15 or 20 minute journey. And about halfway through, my dad, sitting in the front seat driving the car, turned around, looked at me and said, Gunnar, this isn't going to hurt. So I could immediately tell that something was different. I could tell that my parents were nervous. And now by extension, I was nervous because when my dad told me that something wasn't going to hurt, of course, I had no desire to believe him. But there we were. We finally got to the hospital. And instead of going left to cystic fibrosis clinic that I was so familiar with at such a young age, we went to interventional radiology. And I was about to have my first experience with IV antibiotics, apicline. My parents neglected to tell me that that was going to happen to me. So we walk into the interventional radiology unit. They, of course, strip me down. They put me into one of those fashionable medical gowns that we're all too familiar with. An anesthesiologist walked in, could immediately tell that I was a little distraught, nervous, and fear was not too far from where I was standing. She came in and not so much speaking to me, but to my parents as well, who were also in the room with me while we were waiting, and said, let's give Gunnar something to take the edge off a little bit, and prescribed liquid Versed for me to drink. And for those of you who have ever taken Versed, you know exactly what it is and why it's a pretty chill medication to take. But the good first grader that I was had no desire to ever drink a medication, let alone a new medication early in the morning, while I was definitely on the verge of a complete panic attack. So over the next 25 to 30 minutes, a rotating cast of characters walked into our hospital room to try to convince me to drink the medication to calm me down and to take the edge off. But I said no. I kept saying no. I said no to this nurse, that nurse, this anesthesiologist, this doctor, that doctor, until finally the anesthesiologist walked back into the room and said, you know what? We have to get Gunnar to calm down. This procedure is really going to hurt him. He's going to be super uncomfortable. We can't have him squirming around on the table. We might have to put him out for this procedure. And the moment I heard that, I was sitting in my dad's lap. I jumped off. I looked at him square in the eye and I said, you lied to me. Said this wasn't going to hurt. She said it's going to hurt. Who do I believe? I don't have time for this. And I just ran away out the door, through the hallway, through the open area, the lobby area of the hospital, because now it's a few hours later, of course, since we first got there, after all the waiting. And then of course, this circus with the Versed, that now it's packed. So we're in Cincinnati. My dad is finishing his career. He's in the final year of his career playing for the Cincinnati Bengals. Starting quarterback of the Cincinnati Bengals is chasing his belligerent son through the lobby, through crowds of people, through different parts of the hospital, until finally I find myself in a dead end corner where there's a handicap railing on the wall. And I grab onto this handicap railing. My dad describes it as the Vulcan death grip onto this handicap railing, until he finally catches up to me. I'm crying and screaming. He's trying to pull me off. He's like, Gunnar, you're making a scene. Please calm down. This is crazy. Like, we gotta go back in there. You're making us look bad. There's so much going on here, and I will do whatever you want if you go back into that room with me. And the moment he said that, I think that's the time I realized that I wanted to be an MBA, but I also felt that I had the leverage in the situation to make a deal with him. So of course we made a deal that ended up turning out to be a new video game. So not only did I come out of this as the most popular first grader in class, I did reluctantly agree to go back into the interventional radiology suite with him, where I subjected myself to my first ever PICC line. And of course, 2 weeks of antibiotics, as we all know too well. And really the reason I tell this story is because it was my first impact with my first interaction with what I call medical trauma. It was the kind of thing that shaped the way that I saw the health system from an early age, to the point where anytime I was going back for a blood draw, a flu shot, even a blood pressure test where they put the cuff on your arm, I was completely terrified of every single thing that happened to me inside a medical center, because I had this one terrible, terrible experience. So, you grow up, and I lived, I think, what I would consider a pretty typical childhood. I didn't have too many run-ins with my CF or declining disease. declining health rather as I grew up and went through middle school and until I got to high school. And when I got to high school, I sort of understood the value of a team because I played football. At the beginning of my freshman year, I saw that my high school had a small football team. It wasn't a good football team, let me tell you that. But I wanted to play because I wanted to be, someone that could, follow in my dad's footsteps. Growing up around the game, I just wanted to do that more than anything else as a child. You can imagine Sunday afternoons in my household, or in my house, as many households are, just consumed by NFL games. And I grew up loving the game of football. And by the time I got to high school, I wanted to play tackle football. And of course, when I signed up, my parents weren't too pleased. I came home one night and I said, Dad, I'd love to play football. What do you think? Will you sign me up? And he said, you have to ask your mother. And then I went over to my mom and I said, Mom, Dad said I can play football. Can you please sign the dotted line? And away we went. But things weren't all that great for me during my early days. Especially as I jumped on the team. I think my first day of practice was drop everything, run a mile, and just keep working out. And I quickly realized that I was on a different athletic level than most of my friends. As we progressed through high school, while my friends were getting stronger, I was not, to keep it simple. I had a hard time keeping my weight on. I had a hard time putting on muscle mass, but I struggled through. I made it through, and I completed two seasons of my JV football career, my freshman and sophomore year of high school, and had a lot of fun doing it. But by the time I made the varsity team my junior year as the backup quarterback, I think I realized that I was a different level until one day I was actually thrown into a game. And I kind of convinced myself that, yeah, you know what? I think I can do this if I keep working hard with my conditioning and training. So between my junior and senior year of high school, I sort of had this feeling that, okay, I can do this. I will come back. I plan to be the starting quarterback my senior year of high school. That's what I want to do. That's my goal. And then I was struck by mono. And mono for me was probably the first time in my life when I went to my CF clinic and I continued to see over and over and over again that my PFTs were just trending down and they were not coming back up regardless of whatever we did. So for that, the second half of that summer from, July onwards, I was just completely just devastated to see that my health was starting to get into the rest of my life and to really overwhelm every other goal that I sort of had that summer. I'm starting to think about going to college and starting to think about, other parts of life. And for me, it was tough because, CF was just all consuming, but like the stubborn 17-year-old kid that I was, I felt like I could still play football. I could still do it. So when training camp rolled around at the end of August, I showed up like I did any other season and put myself through it. But as I had earlier in my career, started to understand that I was on a different athletic playing field, it was most pronounced when I was about to enter my senior year of high school during that early season training and practice program. I had been a shell of my former self. I had lost weight all summer and I just could not get going. Until one day during training camp, we were doing conditioning and like the stubborn kid that I was, I put myself through it in a hot August day. And then about halfway through a training session, during sprints, we were told to drop down and do push-ups, which of course dropped down and did. And about halfway through my set of push-ups, I collapsed. I found myself face first in the field, kind of rolled myself over eventually. And I looked up and I saw about 10 or 15 of my friends huddled around me as if they had all just seen a ghost. And what they were really looking at was me covered in blood, because I looked down and my shirt was just drenched in this god-awful shade of red that I had never really seen before. And it was the first time I had a massive hemoptysis, and it happened to me at 17 years old in the middle of a football field on Long Island where surrounded by my friends. And it was a little intimidating to say the least, but in a way to shake off, I guess, the embarrassment that I had, I tried to just pop myself up and I look over and I see that the coach is running for me. The training staff is running for me. All of a sudden everyone who knew that I was a high risk person to be there, all their worst nightmares were sort of coming to fruition. And, you know, I was kind of just helped over to the sideline. And I just said, you know what, we just got to call my mom. If we call my mom, she will know what to do. Please just, you know, don't freak out. Don't panic. I can breathe. I'm okay. You know, I know this looks bad, and, you know, I'm kind of making this up as I go, you know, because I had never really happened to me, but I knew that if I could breathe, I would be okay. Until finally we got a hold of my mom, and we also got a hold of the Cystic Fibrosis Center. So my mom picked me up from practice, and we drove right into the CF Center at Columbia, where I had probably the most difficult conversation with a physician up to that point in my life. And the way it went was, you know, we walked in, we saw that my PFTs were going down again. So it's, you know, now going on a third month of tough PFT scores, of tough clinic visits, of tough encounters since my mono set in. And finally, I was presented with a choice by my doctor. My doctor said, you know, Gunnar, we can probably get you through this football season if you really want to. We can give you this option, but I don't think you can finish this season. I think you have to give up your football career. I think this is the end, because we have to start treating this issue seriously. And I was gutted. I was just absolutely devastated that in the matter of 2 minutes, a conversation took away everything that I had worked for in my entire life, and especially during my years in high school. I was forced to confront with the idea and the reality that I was not going to be a starting quarterback for my high school football team. What it also did is it showed me that my cystic fibrosis was not going away. It was with me for the thick and thin, the good times and the bad. And this was an exceptionally bad time for me to be confronted with this reality. So the doctor said, you know, I'll give you this choice. Go home and talk it over with your parents, and then call me, call the clinic in the morning, and we'll get something going. We'll move the gears towards hopefully trying to treat whatever we can. So the entire car ride home, I'm on the verge of tears. My mom calls my dad and, you know, alerts him to how the visit went and the conversation that, you know, he's going to have with me when we get home. Because I think from my mom's perspective, she was worried about letting my health get even worse. You know, I think, you know, any CF parent on the call here knows that watching your child struggle with CF is not an easy thing. And, oftentimes when my parents had to deal with it, you know, they definitely masked it very well. They didn't show fear to me or anything like that. But I think this was a time in our lives where, you know, we were all confronting this new reality that we were living in. So we do get home. My mom had prepped my dad for the chat, and there we are, sort of sitting in like at the study of our house or whatever you want to call it. And he said, Gunnar, you know, I heard about the doctor's appointment. I think there's something I need to tell you, something that's been weighing on my chest for me for far too long, but I have to tell it to you. And I said, what's that, Dad? And he said, well, Gunnar, you are like the worst football player I've ever seen in my entire life. And with that, I think I was just so shocked, just so absolutely shocked that was the way the conversation had gone right off the bat, that I didn't know what to say. I didn't know whether to laugh. I didn't know whether to cry. I didn't know whether to be crushed. But what he was really saying and what would go on to say is that we have no other option here. We have to treat your CF as aggressively as we can, because you have other things in life to think about. You have a hockey season coming up in the winter, and then you also want to go off to college. Like, those are two major things that you want in your life. And those are things that we will, you know, try to get you to, but we can't get to those without addressing this challenge that is confronting you. So you can imagine how this day went. It went from the worst possible moment for me at practice to an even more difficult chat with my doctor and my mom at the clinic, to all of a sudden my dad's telling me, no, this is just one challenge on the way to the rest of your life. Of course, there's going to be other challenges along the way, but we have to deal with this one right here and right now. And that's really what we did. The next morning we called the center. We said the decision has been made. We had to start treatment right away. And lo and behold, I had my first ever bronchoscopy about a week later, and then started weeks and weeks of IV antibiotics to treat the infection that was exacerbated by the mononucleosis, until finally I stabilized and I was healthy enough to compete with my hockey team that season, my senior year season. And then, of course, head off to college. So I went to Boston College, and of course, after a life of CF, you sort of are banged up a little bit. I certainly was, especially after those last few years. But when I got to school, I learned more about, you know, who I was and what I was able to do with my life. than I think I probably had been prepared to do at any other point in my sort of, you know, growing, you know, my childhood or growing up. But the health challenges continued, right? That mononucleosis that I had between my junior and senior year of high school sort of set me on a path of aggressive illness for the next 5 or so years, maybe even, you know, 7 or 8 years as well. So from about the age of 17 years old to, you know, 26, 27 years old, I was going through one health challenge after the next. And the next sort of big one, the big moment in my life, the sort of big health moment in my life, at least, was during my sophomore year of college. I like had some crazy virus. Talk about crazy viruses. I had a crazy virus probably my first semester of that year, which actually sent me home to New York. I was hospitalized. I was treated with another round of antibiotics to sort of support the body's immune response fighting the virus, but also so that I could treat the Pseudomonas that was living in my lungs. I was discharged from the hospital, and then a few days later, something with pancreatitis. So no one really knows how that pancreatitis sort of came on. And if you've never dealt with it, good. I'm happy for you. I hope you never have to. But it is a somewhat of a, I guess, a moderately rare complication that can happen to people with cystic fibrosis. It's just incredibly painful. And the way that it's treated is I had to fast. I had to starve myself. So there I was back in the hospital a week later, and I was fasting as a treatment for my pancreatitis. So over the course of the next week, I just started losing weight until I finally sort of overcame my bout with pancreatitis. And when I left the hospital, I was weighing in at less than 130 pounds. So I'm 6'2". I was essentially skin and bones when I left the hospital that fall of my sophomore year. And on the way out, you know, it sort of dawned upon, I think, all of us that a feeding tube was in my future. And that was the only way forward, was that we had to go with a feeding tube. And like the stubborn kid that I was, my dad will tell you that I resisted my feeding tube for many, many years. But I think that that healthcare was so pronounced that there was just no looking back from it. I will say, however, my doctor in Boston at the time, who had heard about the conversation, my hospitalization, called me when I returned to BC a few weeks later, and said, you know, I want to tell you the story of a woman who was one of my patients many years ago, and her goal was to run the Boston Marathon. She wanted to run the Boston Marathon, but she kept hurting herself during training because she had every classic CF malnutrition symptom. You know, she just wasn't putting on weight, she wasn't putting on muscle mass. And she came to me one day and said, you know, doc, I really had this goal, but my CF is getting in the way of running the Boston Marathon. Is there anything that we can do to give me even just a little bit more strength so that I can do this? And he said, yeah, why don't we try a feeding tube? And lo and behold, she did it. She was so motivated and so driven to finish the Boston Marathon that she was able to do it with a feeding tube. And she, you know, put on a couple pounds, was able to keep on some muscle, and completed the marathon. And the doctor telling me the story was, you know, someone that knew that I was an athletic person. He knew what would motivate me, what would drive me to overcome my fear of this feeding tube, the fear that I had. And looking back, I have no idea why I had this fear, but I did. And I was convinced, right? This was a conversation that I still think about quite frequently when I'm going through a frustrating, rough time, because this doctor knew exactly what I needed to hear, right? He knew that a feeding tube was in my future, whether I wanted it or not. But he knew that I would be more accepting of it if I could convince myself that I did in fact need it. And he did. He did a great job of talking to me and meeting me as a human being and talking about things outside my CF, right? He knew that I wanted to get back to playing hockey and real hockey at BC. I wanted to stop missing school. I wanted to be on campus as much as I could with my buddies. And he told me the story about one of his patients. And I think it was something that I have a great deal of respect for. Right? Because I think there's sometimes a hesitancy to compare patients in CF, and I'm not saying it's a good thing to do all the time, but he took the chance and he took the risk to do it. And I'm glad he did, because I think that it saved my life, right? When I was about 21, 22 years old, I was just completely malnourished at that point in my life. And very quickly, I put on a ton of weight. I'm the kind of person who I'm a picky eater to begin with. And I just, you know, have always had a hard time keeping food down, but the feeding tube definitely did that for me early in my life. But it really was only getting me to a point where I could be healthy enough to kind of just survive, right? So I had to get through the next 2 years of college, which to me sort of felt like a bit of a marathon in and of itself. Because by the time I graduated, I was in a downward spiral that I just could not get myself out of. So graduated the spring of 2013. And about every other month from that point on, I was either dealing with a new exacerbation, a new pulmonary issue, and I was just a frequent flyer at the cystic fibrosis clinic at Columbia because I just could not get on top of whatever it was that was keeping me down. I between 2013 and 2018, I think I went through about 24 medical interventions to deal with my rapidly evolving Pseudomonas infection and my rapidly progressing cystic fibrosis. It got to the point where, you know, what does my life look like when I am, you know, struggling from 1 month to the next, right? I was lucky if I had a good month and a half in there. It was really, really brutal existence. And with every trip to the clinic, you know, you see that PFP number slipping further and further and further down. And that is just gutting, right? You see your PFP number sliding, you know, those numbers are not coming back. And that's exactly how I felt when I was 22, 23, 24 years old. I saw my friends moving on to different jobs, to, you know, having great social lives, to, I was living with my parents and I was lucky if I could, string together a couple good weeks in a row. So what I did to sort of keep myself healthy was I actually went back to coaching. I coached high school football. I coached high school ice hockey. And I credit those things with keeping me on my feet and keeping me with something that I wanted to do, right? I had a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Until one day my doctor approached me with a clinical trial opportunity. And this was back in the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, said, you know, there's a drug trial going on. We'd love to get you involved. Give you something to do. You meet the inclusion criteria. And that was the first time I'd ever done a randomized controlled clinical trial. And for me, it was a mind-blowing experience to be a part of science, to be a part of something bigger than myself. It gave me purpose. And to this day, I say that people living with rare diseases have the ability to control the prognosis of their own condition through their willingness to participate in research. And I'm not just talking about like the sexy CFTR rescue, you know, studies. I'm talking about everything else, right? Every other part of cystic fibrosis study and every other part of cystic fibrosis care and science is in some way or another reliant on the patient to push forward, right? That is the thing that we all have to do to make sure that our disease moves forward for our clinicians to better treat us. And I think that as a 23, you know, 22, 23 year old, when I first enrolled into a trial, it was, of course it didn't work back then, but I still felt like I did something, right? I provided the no or the failure, right? I provided that answer so that we could move on to the next thing. Then I enrolled in another clinical trial, which also failed, but that was another no, that was another step in the right direction to hopefully finding something that would maybe not only work for myself, but everyone else too. And I think that, being in a clinical trial is a very interesting experience because it feels like you're actively doing something, but it's also not super difficult to do. And give my doctor a lot of credit for asking me to be in one. And now these days, whenever I get asked, I just say yes. Like, it's a very easy thing for me to do. So it wasn't until, of course, the 2018, when I was in the TRIKAFTA program, that things really started to turn around for me. But I do want to pause quickly and talk about a few trial opportunities or a few research opportunities that might be out there that you may not have heard of. One is the HERO2 study that's being done by Indiana University. That one's really cool because it's home reported, right? It's all about you entering your information into an app to see how you're doing. You can go to hero2study.com to look at that. Then I've got two mental health trials on here, one for adults and one for teens. The contact information is there as well. I think that one's cool because I think mental health is an under sort of appreciated part of living with cystic fibrosis. I think it's part of this, I think it's something that was probably overlooked while we were sort of driving for therapeutic change. So I'm excited that mental health is now in the forefront for people with CF. And there is something that I definitely am taking an interest in, and contact information for you is there as well. And then, of course, I think Dr. Koff and Dr. Chan from Yale were talking on the conference either yesterday or the day before about the things they're dealing with phages at Yale. And that's definitely something that I think is duly needed, is looking to different ways to deliver antimicrobials and antibiotics to deal with our evolving and heavily resistant infections. So I got to say that as we all know, as a lot of people have benefited from Trikafta over the past, however many years from approval, I guess, is, we're coming on 2 years now. My life has been unlocked, right? I had a massive turnaround from requiring intervention every other month, right? I probably dropped 30 to 40% of my treatment load. I really have no need to dedicate nearly as much time as I once did to my health. And it allowed me to think about, what do I want with the rest of my life? It made me think about, how can I reinvent myself? Grad school was a very natural choice, but of course, what about family building, right? What about the other parts of life that aren't necessarily touching our career? And that's where I met Darcy, and Darcy has been by my side. She is the love of my life, and we got married this past June, and where we let everyone know at our wedding as a big secret, a big reveal, that Darcy and I had been going through IVF treatments for quite some time now. She also lives with an autoimmune disorder and some other underlying health conditions. So as we started, getting closer and dating for a longer and longer period of time, the idea of family building came up, and it came up pretty often to the point where, we said, why don't we just get a consultation with a fertility specialist in New York City, and we'll see what they say, right? We'll see what they say, because frankly, I wasn't getting very much information from, the website, from the web, the internet, or from the cystic fibrosis clinic. The only things that we kind of knew were anecdotes from other patients who had gone through family building. So we saw the specialist in New York City for a consultation, and she recommended that we get going quickly with our IVF. So this is before we were married. And when I heard that, I was like, oh wow, I gotta turn up the time on my plan to propose and then marry Darcy. But then of course the pandemic sort of set in and complicated all of that. But we went through it, and the thing that frustrated us the most was that there was just a general lack of information about how we could prepare ourselves for the medical interventions required for IVF, right? So as many of us may know, that in CF, there are infertility for both men. There are infertility issues for both men and women living with CF, but especially for men. We are born with a congenital absence of the vas deferens, meaning sperm can't exit our body the natural way. So we have to go through a sperm extraction so that we can move forward with IVF. But before you can even do that, there are a whole slew of tests that you have to get done. Darcy had to be tested as whether or not she was a CF carrier, which presented its own challenges, because until you are trying to go through it, you have to start thinking about, well, should we do the standard genetic panel, the expanded one, the comprehensive one? And our cystic fibrosis clinic wasn't much to help, because presumably people are diagnosed before they even step foot inside of a CF clinic. Our OBGYN wasn't super helpful, did not know what to do. And there we were kind of flying blind until we eventually talked to a friend of ours with CF and said, no, you have to do this one specific test. It's a comprehensive CF gene panel that will test for every single gene that is known. And we did that. Darcy was not a carrier, so we were able to proceed with the IVF process from baseline testing for me, baseline testing for her. And then what I'm calling the search and rescue mission to my nuts, where we extracted the sperm. And I got to tell you, I was terrified for that procedure. Let this be a word of calm and reassurance that it wasn't that bad. I was able to hold a conversation with the doctor while he was doing it, which is weird in its own right. Turned out he was a college lacrosse player, and I was talking about college lacrosse while I was getting sperm extracted. But from there, we went through the most challenging parts of IVF, which are the parts that Darcy had to do and that all women have to do when they go through IVF, from daily injections to medical monitoring and frequent lab draws, and of course the egg retrieval and then the embryo transfer. And every single part of it is like anxiety provoking, just because you don't know what's going to happen. There's like, there's almost no guarantee at any point of the process. So seeing her strength and courage go through it has been my inspiration for the past several months. I know it's going to be my inspiration probably for the rest of my life, just because, you know, everything that I've gone through felt like it paled in comparison to the few months that Darcy had to go through with the IVF process. We were fortunate enough that an embryo did stick, and we're now expecting a baby boy coming in December. And I think my few takeaways from the whole the IVF process are this. One, the cost is ridiculous, right? And it's now a personal goal and vendetta of mine to figure out how we can make it more affordable for people with cystic fibrosis, right? There has to be a financial support program for people going through IVF, especially folks who are going through the comprehensive IVF process. So that is a goal of mine, and that's something that that I'm taking away and taking away in stride, because that's something that I want other people with CF to have an opportunity to do. Two, the lack of information is just mind-boggling, right? From the CF clinic all the way through every other part of the health system, it's like you're going through a maze with a blindfold on, because you just have no idea where to look or turn. I'm super fortunate because Darcy is a licensed trauma psychotherapist. So she's familiar with reading medical literature on, you know, behavioral health. So she took those skills and went right into the world of IVF medical literature, which is international. It's wide, it's broad, it's dense, it's general. And she, it wouldn't be too infrequent that I'd walk in to the bedroom before we were about to go to sleep, and there she was reading another journal, you know, journal article and, you know, some medical journal. So I had a great deal of respect for people who are going through IVF, people who have gone through IVF, but it is a goal of mine to make it easier, more streamlined, and I'm hoping cystic fibrosis clinics are able to eventually catch up with the IVF process. So finally, I'm gonna sort of turn, and what am I watching for in the future of CF before we'll move on to the Q&A session here is, one, I wanna take our wins from the telehealth experiment of the last, you know, year and a half of the COVID pandemic and bring them into the standard of care, right? For me, I have found that telehealth is frustrating on one hand because you can't get a very clear picture of what CF care is. You know, CF is a progressive disease. And of course, any one wrong thing can set off a whole slew of other issues. So we can't substitute telehealth for all care. But I think especially as people are improving with their health and people are able to stabilize their improving health in this new generation of CF, we have to incorporate those telehealth wins into the standard of care. Is it really worth it for people with CF to be going to a hospital, to a medical center, to a CF clinic 4 times a year when we can just call in, we can dial in? I think that's one thing that I have a hope for in the future. Two, we just talked about it. Sexual and reproductive health needs to be a priority area with patients now living longer. That's critically important to me, and I hope that starts from a very early age. Three, for the love of God, someone needs to make new antibiotics, right? I mean, full stop. That kind of thing is frustrating me. Of course, there's a lot at play more than, you know, folks than companies just not wanting to go into antibiotics. There's market issues there that need to be resolved by our policymakers. And then finally, it's something that I'm very passionate about, and it's why I joined the board of No Patient Left Behind. New CF drugs must go generic without undue delay upon their exclusivity cliff. And what that means is drug makers just can't pursue a policy of rent-seeking behavior, right? They can make their profit, before their patented exclusivity periods end, and that sort of harkens back to the Hatch-Waxman Act and the Orphan Drug Act in the several decades ago. But they can't exploit that, right? There's a very fragile balance between our drug makers, our payers, patients, and policymakers, and that exclusivity cliff is there that ties it all together. And what I want to see is that our drug makers really are beholden to that exclusivity cliff and move forward into the next generation of CF care. So with that, I just want to say thanks again. I will open this up. I guess we're doing a little Q&A. And again, thanks to Siri and everyone at CFRI for inviting me to talk this afternoon.
And thank you, Gunnar. Wow, what a great presentation. And yes, it is time for questions. And Siri will moderate that.
Hi there, Gunnar. Thank you so very much. I'm going to let people, if they want to screenshot your slide to get your contact info, and then I'll ask you to stop the share so we can see you.
Yes, I will stop the share. Here we go.
And if people didn't have time to get that information, we will definitely share it afterwards. So thank you. And we're all so happy for you and Darcy. It's just such fabulous news, and what a gift to everybody that you're sharing that journey. I guess that's territory you know well, that you've been in the public spotlight right from the beginning. And I guess that leads to a question. You have the privilege of celebrity, but also the burden, I'm sure, that you never really did have a choice, as you said, about being the face of CF for many. How would you guide other parents, especially in this day and age, about what they disclose and share about their child's CF?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something that I talk a lot about with, especially high schoolers with CF and their parents, when they're going on to college. And it's important to think carefully and thoroughly about the choice to talk openly about CF, right? If you're going through an athletic recruiting process, if they're going through scholarship processes or anything like that, there may be potential ramifications for disclosing CF, as we all kind of hope that isn't the case. But you hear too often that sometimes being too open can have a negative consequence. But on the other side, you do hear stories about people going off to college and hiding their CF even from their roommates or from other people. And then because of that, I think that second scenario kind of scares me more. I think it's important for parents to talk openly with their kids about CF, to talk openly with their friends about CF. I remember growing up, and whenever I had a play date, at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, my parents would, regardless of the time of the day, just start my treatments when my friends came over to the house, so that my friends could see what it was like to live with CF, right? There's one thing to be told about what it means to live with CF. It's another thing entirely to actually see what it looks like. And I think from that kind of perspective, that like micro level perspective, it's critically important that the support system builds around people with CF from a very, very early age.
We had another question. Do you have any concerns about your child or children? Maybe there are more, Gunnar.
I can tell you, I can promise you there's only one right now. I don't have a fear about there being my child, or my son, having a one CF mutation. I think before we even began the IVF process, before we went with sperm extraction or the egg retrieval, the first kind of step is the genetic panel to see if Darcy has CF herself. As soon as we found that she does not, we pursued no further genetic testing, right? We did not do genetic testing before the embryo was planted. We did not do genetic testing as soon as the embryo was sort of created in the petri dish. I think we saw that because Darcy did not have a mutation that we had to worry about, we just sort of saw it as a green light to go forward. We kind of joke that we call him the big fat science baby, because he's the byproduct of a lot of different acts of science, right? I'm only at this point because of Trikafta first. Second, we were doing this in the middle of the pandemic, so I had to be vaccinated. She got a vaccine, and we went through all this IVF miracle, which is science into of itself. So we call him the big fat science boy because he's a byproduct of a lot of things going on in a lot of different labs all over the world.
That is amazing. Let's see, there's a question, as an adult beyond your poster child years, can you say about when you became so involved in the CF community and how that impacted your own experience of the disease?
You know, I think for me, I kind of always grew up around fundraisers. I always grew up around CF events. So it was just sort of ingrained in my life as if it would be something that I would always kind of do. But the real reason I sort of got into like the patient advocacy world is that when I graduated college and my health was sort of in decline, I had to put off my dream of going to law school. So it's hard to believe that like the world needed another lawyer. But I had this great big plan to go to law school. Darcy always pokes fun at me for my dream having been to be a litigator. It's not my dream anymore, but I needed something to do. So I got involved with the CF scholarship program at BEF. That was like my first sort of job responsibility. And getting to talk to other people with CF on the phone during interviews and scholarship diligence and, you know, you go through, you know, 45, 50 conversations with people with CF really quickly. And you get to meet and talk to a lot of great people out there living with CF who have made their CF well-known, people who aren't very open about their CF for a number of different reasons. And you get to hear about what they're going through and then you relate it to your own experience. And I was just hooked immediately. So from there, you know, responsibility started to tack on. And for me, it's part of my life really.
We have a question about your sister. Can you talk about life with a sister?
Yeah, so my sister, Sydney, she does not have CF. She's actually not even a carrier for the CF gene. She and I grew up like best friends. I often kind of tell the story about the time that I went to like a party as a seventh grader. I played spin the bottles, first time I, you know, kissed a girl kind of thing. And my sister was right there when I got home from the party, wanting to know everything, of course, spreading rumors about her older brother. And of course, trying to figure out who she needs to talk to because they may have mistreated me. But I think that's sort of kind of like a microcosm of our relationship. She has been my biggest fan and she has been my biggest supporter and protector for my entire life. And the reason, you know, it's similar to reasons that I described earlier about how my parents, you know, always had my friends over when I would, when I always had me do treatments when I had my friends over. When I didn't have friends over, my CF treatments were like a social time in the house, right? From a very early age, the rule was that I couldn't do my treatments alone, right? So, and the reason I couldn't do my treatments alone is because I couldn't believe that they were taking me away from something that was going on inside the house. So my treatments were always set up in a communal area, like a TV room or the kitchen or like the room off the kitchen. And whether my mom would sit with me, my dad would sit with me, or my sister would sit with me, would kind of be like a rotating carousel. But we got a lot of great family time that way, right? It's extra time that my parents built in that I could spend with my sister every single day. And we loved it. I mean, to this day, I keep my treatments in a very communal room. I've never done them in my bedroom, even in college. Which is of course presents its own challenges in college when people see what you're doing. But I think my parents had a great parenting trick, and it was to make my sister and I just love each other so much that we felt like we always had to be with each other.
In college, didn't you have somebody see you use your nebulizer for the first time and finally got the courage to ask for a hit?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. The first time I did my treatments in college, my buddy, who's like still one of my best friends today, kind of looked at me with a strange face and was like, are you going to pass that or what? And thinking of course that it was like a vaporizer or marijuana or something. And I was like, that's not what this is. And then of course, there I am explaining what cystic fibrosis is to, you know, 15 new faces. And I think just because I was so open with my college friends, like they're all still my best friends today. And, to me, that's like, I feel very fortunate to have such a great group of friends.
Just not having the burden of masking it or hiding it.
Yeah.
There's a question. How did you learn about the prognosis of CF? And at what age would you tell a child with CF, if at all? CF has changed, you know, CF has changed over time. But
yeah. You know, I think I have a lot of feelings about the life expectancy stat, the median age of death stat. For me, I think I became numb to it very early on because a lot of times those statistics are used as like fundraising and markers of success with fundraising. So, you know, I it never like occurred to me. My parents never sat me down and were like, you know, Gunnar, you're gonna live to 25 years old. You know, that was never like a conversation. You know, I don't ever remember having a doctor talk to me about that kind of thing. The only thing my parents will say about, you know, those days, and it's the story that I've heard over and over again, is that when I was diagnosed, you know, Pulmozyme had just been approved. And a doctor came out and said, you know, there's drugs on the way. That was back when we thought, you know, the gene therapy thing was going to work out. And you know, they had, they told my parents, you know, Gunnar's going to go to college one day. That is something that we can tell you with some degree of certainty will come true. And of course I went to college. And then as soon as I started living past that, I felt like it was free time. But to answer the question, I do think that it's important for parents to probably talk about it before they hear it at a fundraiser and without context, right? I think I just kept hearing it over and over again that I made my own conclusions. And I also do think that kids are smart these days, right? They know how to use the internet, they know how to Google search, and they will find it whether or not you tell them. So I think it's important to have that conversation, but not in a fearful way, right? Like the prognosis for CF is changing, and frankly, it's quite good now.
Something that's come up kind of frequently as a topic in many of the presentations and in the chat box is about medical trauma. Yeah. And, you know, I think of when CFRI did the externally led patient focused drug development meeting, and you were one of the participants, and we were, you know, talking through what was to be shared before it. And you said, oh, you know, I had pancreatitis like 5 times. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Erk!" You put the brakes on. Tell us about pancreatitis, because from all I've heard, it is sheer hell. And it just made me think about how much is internalized by people with CF that just daily, that becomes almost minimized almost by necessity. And yet it is there as medical trauma. So I just want to plant the seed that I feel like between CFRI and the Wilmer Esiason Foundation, we should be talking about strategies for addressing medical trauma in our community.
Yeah, I think it's a big problem. You know, I of course told the story where I ran away from the interventional radiology suite as a child. But the truth is I was terrified of getting IVs or PICC lines or whatever until probably college. You know, I remember any time that it was broached, the subject was brought up that, you know, a PICC line might be in my future, you know, I was like on the verge of tears, right? And this is like through high school. You know, as like, you know, a budding adult, to the point where like, no one had ever like asked me how I felt about it, right? It was always just kind of prescribed. And the reason I, you know, think back on so many influential, you know, medical moments is for things like that, right? It's like things that I've pushed through, things that I've gotten through. But the truth is, you know, as I've gotten older, and especially when I was going through my hard years right after college, before I entered the TRIKAFTA program, you know, I had a number of conversations with my doctor about, okay, you know, the antibiotics are starting to fail, right? And as soon as you hear that for the first time, as soon as you, you know, see and hear that a drug that you've relied on, or many drugs that you've relied on for your entire life, are starting to fail, like that is a gut-wrenching moment as well. And I think, you know, I don't want to put this on the CF care providers because they're conveying information, but, you know, when you see a doctor and like, you have a conversation like that, like I'm bringing 20 years of experience of having these like terrible moments into the clinic with me. And I do think that you're right, that I think it's like just an under appreciated issue. And I am hopeful that moving forward, you know, as prognosis increases and, you know, therapeutics aren't necessarily the only priority, you know, we can start thinking about the entire patient that is sitting and present in the clinic.
That is a great way to end the Q&A session. I'm getting the sign that I'm to throw this back to Jim, but Gunnar, unbelievable presentation. We are all so grateful to you and grateful to Darcy because you're sharing her story too. And we're just grateful we get to follow along with this exciting journey you're on now.
Yeah, thanks, Siri. I really appreciate it. And yeah, you're right. Darcy is the real brains behind the operation in our house. That is one thing I'm absolutely certain of.
Yes, thank you, Gunnar. That was awesome. Well, hard to believe, but we're getting to the end of the program. And if you're like me, your head's about ready to explode from all this information we've taken in over the weekend. So I do want to thank you for the honor of being your MC for the weekend. And I also want to thank Jerry, Melanie, and our tech crew behind the scenes. They have just done such a great job. I mean, to pull something like this off virtually is mind-numbing. And they overall did a great job. And so with that, I am going to pass the microphone back to Siri because she's got some things to give away and there's still a couple of things going on, right, Siri?
There, I've been sneaking back and forth to look at the leaderboard. Unbelievably, we have a tie for the first and second place. So I think really the only fair way to do that is that we will combine the gift cards, divide by two for our one and two. So hang on, I have to tilt my screen to find the names. Maggie Williamson and Linda Bowman, you have tied for the first. And Krista Ising, you are in third place. So those are locked in and we will touch base with all of you so that we can get you either the Amazon or the Etsy gift cards that you have won. And I'm really grateful to everybody who participated in that so that we could, well, it just made it more fun, A, and B, we just love encouraging that people really took the time to go through and visit with our sponsors and our exhibitors and you know, look at the CFAN booths and Roxia Foundation booth. So thank you all. So unbelievably, after planning for a year, it seems crazy that the conference is coming to a close. This has just been an incredible event for me. I hope it has been for you. And it's made all the more significant in light of the tragedies of the pandemic. And planning this conference was a grand adventure. All of us at CFRI sought to create a virtual environment that would still engender community and connection, and we so hope you experience this. We are greatly indebted to the phenomenal speakers, volunteers, exhibitors, sponsors who participated this weekend as an act of service to our CF community. Thank you for sharing your valuable time and your expertise. And if we could all hear each other, this is the one hard thing about this, not hearing the sound of everybody's here, I'm sure you would all hear raucous cheers and receive a standing ovation. There are no words. But the other people I want to thank here are the attendees. The chat box this weekend, it's been incredible. Your comments, shared experiences, questions taught me so much. And they also provided guidance on ways CFRI can better support you. Shout out to Gabriella for her continued advocacy to always have high quality captioning. And the chat box also suggested CFRI sponsored ASL classes and other ideas. And I do admit the regular Zoom dance party was my hope. I've said it before, but CFRI does aim to be responsive to community needs, and we can only do this with your input. So thank you so much. As you know, this conference has attendees from around the globe, which means we are straddling countless time zones. For those of you who missed some of the presentations because they fell at 3 o'clock in the morning your time, the good news is that you can log back into the conference platform using your same login information for the next 30 days to catch up on anything you missed. And then after 30 days, all that content will be released on CFRI's YouTube channel and Podbean channel. And as I said earlier, we will be adding subtitles in Hindi and Spanish to much of that content. A reminder to everyone that at 2 o'clock Pacific, 5 o'clock Eastern, we'll be holding support and discussion groups. We have an amazing selection of 8 different groups. If you haven't been in the lounge yet and looked at the list, please do. My warm thanks to all the facilitators. They are volunteering their time today to lead these groups. And so again, you can go to the lounge, click on them, you'll see the topic. You can choose your group, you will enter that room. So on behalf of everyone at CFRI, I thank you all for being a part of this extraordinary community. I hope the conference provided new information, valuable resources, and a renewed sense of community that continues to sustain you through these extraordinarily challenging days into the future. Members of the conference committee are looking forward to planning our 2022 conference. It's going to require creativity to achieve our goal to blend, if possible, COVID permitting, the in-person experience with a virtual experience that's as engaging as this one. We hear you loud and clear. A quality virtual experience is here to stay. I am honored to share the CF journey with you all. Together in partnership, we'll continue to support those living with the disease while never, never retreating from our mission in search to find a cure. hope that you and yours are safe and well. We hope to see you virtually or in person next year at our 35th annual conference. Thank you all so much.